This podcast is supported by The Real Real.
You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. My name is Zachary Mallory, and I am the host of this podcast. I want to give a very quick viewer discretion is advised due to the nature of the unhinged topics that you are most likely going to hear about here very shortly. I am very excited to welcome my friend Jay, JC. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey there. Good afternoon.
How's it going?
I'm pretty good today. I can't complain. I got to read a little bit, spend a little bit of time outside. How about you?
Hey, you know what? I think spending time outside is a very good thing. I think it's good for the serotonin, especially with the weight of the world right now and the weight of the country. I think it's really good to get outside, get some fresh air, you know, sit back, relax, maybe, you know, drink some tea, do whatever you got to do to focus on that self-care aspect, right? Because the work that you do, the work that I do, the work that a lot of advocates do, it's very tumultuous. You know, the vicarious trauma does truly exist. So what I would love for you to do is just kick us off by sharing who you are, where you've been, where you are now, and where you're headed. And we'll also kind of like break into each one of those parts here shortly. But let's start with the, you know, walk us through childhood, walk us through victim to survivor, and then just kind of fill in the blanks there throughout. You know what I mean?
Sounds great to me.
All right, go ahead.
All right. So my name is Jay or JC. I typically go by Jay in the organizing movements just for an anonymity, as you know. I am a survivor of gender-based violence, and I know we're going to talk about that more in depth, but just generally, my first experience was when I was 12, 13, so like a tween, young teen. I was a seventh grader and experienced, unfortunately, what I'm now learning is not normal, but to me, it was bizarre, unique. Nobody in my life had gone through it. There was about six or seven boys in my grade, in my class, who over the course of the year sexually harassed me, led to death threats on my life and a mental breakdown at school, maybe spring of that year, and spiraled to me going to court with these people and having a very negative experience that re-traumatized me in court, which later on led to me not reporting a date rape. Before we get that far, it also kind of labeled me as a feminist derogatory, eighth grade through my senior year of high school. I was kind of like picked on, but I didn't necessarily take it too hard because I had a lot of confidence as a teenage girl. It wasn't until like my senior year of high school when some of the harassment got kind of bad again that I started to kind of like take some of that personally. I started seeing a counselor through my high school. And then I went to college, started off as a gender and women's studies major, was date raped a little bit after the red zone time. If you're familiar with the red zone, we're actually in it right now. I ended up not reporting it because of my first experience and dissociated for a couple of years. Ended up being a victim advocate. and burning out really quickly. And now I am still in victim services. I do advocacy and organizing work through Philly Feminist, as well as Survivors for Justice Reform, which is actually how I met you and the Rise Above Justice movement. We were in a breakout group together, I want to say in like February or March of this year. And I remember just really connecting with your mission and how you started off during the last presidential election. And we connected later on because of the work that I know the movement's looking to do in the future on police brutality. My heart is in research. I really love working with survivors, and I'm hoping to actually pivot to a more restorative justice based role, or conflict resolution based. That's a little bit outside of the punitive criminal justice system, because I've experienced some real bullshit the last couple of years that contributed to my burnout. So that's a kind of long-winded introduction to who I am. I still am the crazy feminist that people branded me as a teen. It's just I've become more, I guess, educated. I have gone from liberal to progressive to undefined leftist, and that leads my politics. And my, I guess, life and everything that I do since.
Absolutely. I'm sitting here listening to you talk, and I'm thinking of like the unhinged feminist. It's such a I love, if we're gonna use labels, at least it's a label that we can actually, have fun with, right? And I love your personality, and yeah, you're right. Back in February, we were both on the same call and we were in the breakout room, and hearing you talk about the work that you do, and then I was like, oh, this is gonna be a perfect like fit, and we were just getting started as a Rise Above Justice movement. We came very far. We still got a lot of work to do, and we're still gonna continue doing the work that we're doing, even under pressure, right? And you talked specifically about burnout a little bit ago, towards the beginning of your introduction. And that's something I would like to talk about very, very broadly, because oftentimes it's not really discussed in like victim advocacy, is the real like vicarious trauma and the burnout that victim advocates face. So if you're able to do so, I would love to hear what led to the burnout. You know what I mean? And
Yes.
just kind of talk about that, go as, in depth as we would like to. Obviously, this is, I want to give everybody, the feeling that this is a safe space. Yes, it's a podcast, but it's also a safe space. It's unhinged, unfiltered, and, it gives the voice to the marginalized voices that do not reach those headlines. That's the entire mission of our podcast and our movement, is to put the human behind statistics and hear the actual stories of people who have the lived experience and have the trauma and how they overcome it. Because, there's different pipelines between victim to survivor and then activist to advocate. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that too. But let's go back and walk me through the burnout and what you were feeling, what you saw, what you heard. And yeah, just walk me through what led to that.
Yeah, so there's a lot of it. I think what I want to start off with is by saying I am a bitch who barks. Like I say that all the time, like be a bitch who barks. I am a bitch who barks. I do have a personality that you either really, really like me, or I really, really, really rub you the wrong way, and there's not a whole lot of in between. So I do want to say, in the spirit of conflict resolution and restoration, as a survivor, I definitely went through some very unhinged periods where I ultimately had to seek mental health treatment, but we could probably get to that later in my story. I've always been someone that's given authority a difficult time. So that's a big part of what led to the burnout, as well as the gender-based violence that I worked with every single day. So those are like the two big, I guess, categories that I'll draw from. I absolutely loved being a victim advocate. I don't believe in labor. I do not believe in dream jobs, but like I genuinely think the job that I graduated and got, pretty soon thereafter was as close to a dream job as I could have gotten because I was working directly with victims of crime in Philadelphia, and I had kind of built a base with survivors of rape, domestic or IPV, intimate personal violence, some stalking cases. It all ended up being very gender-based, through the 5 years of me being there. And I connected to some really great clients, but their stories were so devastating that it ultimately impacted my mental health. I remember there was a time, I want to say maybe May of this year, May 2025, like right before losing my job and all of the things that happened after that. I was working on a very difficult case that did include some police misconduct with the way that they were talking to my particular client. And I'm going to try to like give, very general information because this is still a case that's open. But I, went with this individual to her interview with the detectives and listened to a detective victim shame her, talk down on her because she didn't block her abuser's phone number, talk down on her because she didn't kick him out or was like living with someone that, leaned into her a lot financially. And when ultimately he was let out on bail, he fled the area. And for months, they weren't able to really find out where he was. He was making threats online. And this person just ended up having like a massive mental breakdown, as you would imagine, and had leaned a lot into me as not only her advocate, but as a friend, because to be honest, advocates, sometimes we do become more friendly to these people because not everybody has the social networks in their individual lives with their with families or like friends. Like they might only have me or like a couple of other people. So this person was leaning into me a lot, and we had a conversation one day where she literally told me that the only reason that she didn't kill her, that she didn't like kill herself, was because of me. Like her crime, like the crime that happened to her, the re-traumatization from the criminal justice system, them letting her abuser flee and not really knowing where he went, was making her so depressed that the only lifeline was me. And I ended up being that person for a lot of people throughout the years. And that ultimately led to my burnout. And when I had reached out to the authority in my organization and, explained the circumstances, I was straight up told by my boss, "Oh, well, it's a good thing that she told you that. You just have to compartmentalize because it's better she said that than killed herself," basically. Like she told me, like, when people tell me things like that, I kind of take it as like a win, like, yay, like this is a case win. And like, honestly, that threw me for a fucking loop because I'm not in this work to be like savior, and like this work is gonna fuck you up, especially when people start talking about, suicide and these very strong feelings. I absolutely lacked the support in my agency. Authority didn't like when I questioned why I didn't get support. They didn't like when I questioned different policies, and then ultimately, as I was burning out, I asked for a couple of accommodations. I'm also neurodivergent. I know we made a couple of jokes earlier. Listen, I'm late stage diagnosed. I'm not gonna out myself in this political climate, but I've been going through some really interesting grieving processes, as also healing from trauma and asking for accommodations, and soon thereafter losing my job was a real big fuck you after I spent, nearly 6 years there, was completely burnt out throughout the summer to the point that I now only am able to work close to full-time hours. Like I work as a victim assistance specialist now, really love that job. It's completely different. It's more safety planning and I have more support. I'm able to have firmer boundaries. So like literally right now I'm starting to look for a full-time job again. Like that's how fucked up I was. So from what, like June 4th through today, September 22nd, literally haven't been able to work full-time because of how fucked up I was from being burnt out. And it was a long burnout. Like it was a long time coming. It was three directors that had their own issues that we could get into, or maybe not, we'll see. It was a long time coming, and victim services and advocacy just it lacks internal infrastructure to support burnout. What I feel like people between the second, third year mark, they flock out of the field. Some people make it to 5, 6 years like me, but realistically, there's very few people in this field that lasts decades because of burnout, and a lot of that is institutional. Self-care is, but on the individual, they kind of like wipe their hands clean and just expect us to get therapists and basically fuck off.
Yeah, absolutely. And I you hit on a lot of really important.
This podcast is supported by The RealReal. You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts, real gifts, thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The RealReal. The RealReal is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The RealReal. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail? Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
Important topics. And I want to, bring it back around really quick. And because, the burnout amongst victim advocates is absolutely a prevalent and under-researched problem. And, the compassion fatigue and the secondary, traumatic stress and the high demand of the workloads, and especially in high areas, some states have higher rates of crime versus others. And, that mindful awareness and the self-compassion, I think, you recognize that you're hitting this burnout. And I think that's absolutely incredible. The exposure to trauma and that the resource limitations, and then also like the emotional demands and the lack of, like you said, the lack of organizational support also contributes to that burnout. And whenever you were getting close to the burnout, how were you feeling? Like, what was your thoughts? What were your emotions? How did it affect you? You talked a little bit about like mentally, but what about that physical part? You know what I mean? So like it does go hand in hand, which is why we stress so incredibly much that your physical health is just as important as your mental health, and your mental health is just as important as your physical health. But walk me through the physiological signs that you were experiencing.
Yeah, absolutely. I am very in tune with my body, and there were a lot of physical, impacts from burnout. I remember, like it was, like I said, it was very slow. So I slowly had a really hard time taking care of my plants, and then l lost some of my appetite because I was so stressed out, I couldn't eat. And then I noticed later in the spring, so again, this would probably be around May, I was honestly in fight or flight all the time. And I felt my chest, I felt as if there was like, I guess, a boulder on my chest, and it never went away when I was at work or honestly doing anything related to victim advocacy. I knew that I needed to take time off. I did physically take time off, like I put a vacation request in. But when I came back, I still wasn't feeling right because, again, I was asking for very explicit things, one of which was verbal conversations, one of which was to touch base with someone about a project that I was having a hard time knowing what to do next related to interns. And then just generally, I was kind of questioning the way that my supervisor was talking to me. And the entire time, I felt like I was going to throw up. Like, I wasn't able to basically share my thoughts, opinions without feeling like I was doing something wrong. I genuinely felt like I was on eggshells. I did not feel supported. I felt like anything I said or did was going to be taken the wrong way. It was just very, very difficult for me. I was incredibly tired. I was sleeping a lot, losing weight because of the loss of appetite and sleeping. But yeah, definitely indicator to me of burnout is definitely when I start to lose interest in my plants and my books.
Absolutely. The plants are very important. I'm just going to say that up front. The plants are absolutely important. And I've always been told that you're supposed to talk to your plants whenever you water them.
Yes.
But here's the thing, them motherfuckers start talking back, it's going out the window. I'm going to be fully honest here. But we talk about some very serious subjects on this podcast, like burnout amongst victim advocates. We talk about restorative justice, we talk about survivors, but you also gotta laugh at some things because this will absolutely drive you up a fucking wall if you don't. And you gotta have fun with it because, again, these are very heavy topics, very heavy stories to share. And, let's walk through. You talked about a little bit about what you experienced as a child. And obviously, that led you down to becoming a victim advocate. Let's talk about what it was like for you in like elementary school, middle school, high school. Walk me through, what did you do before your first experience with trauma? Did you fit into like any of the cliques? Because in school, like you have one side of the room is like your sports, like your jocks. The other side is like the theater kids. And then over here, you have like the gothic kids. And then over here, you have the queer kids. And then over here, you have a combination of like all the above. Like, I just can't really fit in. That's where I was. That's where I personally was. I sat by myself oftentimes at lunch because I couldn't stand anybody that was around me. We just did our 10-year reunion and I did not show up because for a lot of obvious reasons. Because where the hell have they been at this entire time? They have been absent, and it's been 10 years. They weren't there for me. The 18 that I was in school, they're not there in the last 10. So that's how I see it. Anyway, and I know a lot of people relate to that. They always say that your friendships don't always last after you graduate high school. That's absolutely correct. But walk me through what it was like growing up for you, like before your first experience of the trauma.
Yeah, absolutely. So I will say I absolutely never ever fit in. I was always the shy kid. Well, I shouldn't say always. I kind of feel like maybe that kind of started to change 7th into 8th grade. But I was always the shy kid, kind of like considered weird. One of my best friends also always kind of considered weird. But then this best friend and I, and this is so fucked up. This best friend and I, who I'm actually still friends with to this day, like we started our friendship as 4th graders. When we entered 6th grade, we both started developing incredibly early. That's why I said, like earlier, what was happening to me was unique, but it's not actually a unique story across America. Like I've since connected with so many people that have similar things have happened. But we both started developing at the same time, and the boys our age, they noticed, and we both started getting a lot of unwanted attention. For me, this especially was in 7th grade, where in my class, want to say it was like very early on into the school year, I remember boys starting to make bets about who could touch my butt first. Who could get me to sleep with them by the end of the year? I was in 7th grade. I was a child. Again, I was in 7th grade. This unwanted attention like just got worse as time went on. Like very early on, like I wasn't like fighting back. I was kind of like ignoring it, rolling my eyes, scoffing. But it became more of a threat. Like at one point, I remember I did start to like clap back, as we'd say nowadays, because these people would chase me down the hallways or like corner me in classrooms and just be absolutely fucking nuts. I remember one day like yelling back at them, "Hey, like you're acting like this because you have small feet. You know what that means? You know what small feet means? It means small D word." First of all, definitely shouldn't have been saying that as a seventh grader, but this starts the story of like the imperfect victimhood that I definitely want to weave into this conversation. I got kind of pushed to the point of exploding, saying that, and I remember literally having a mental breakdown at school where I like exited, like closing my locker and like hung out in the bathroom for the second half of the day, and my friends had to find me, and they eventually took me to the school counselor where I ultimately explained what was happening throughout the year. And this was at the same time then that the boys, you know, started to kind of start to get in trouble. They were threatening my life. I was explicitly threatened by one boy that he was going to hang me by my neck. And we ended up going to court that summer. And what I will say before we get into like, you know, second part of what I'm sure we'll talk about is going to court completely changed me as a person. I started to kind of find my personality, my interests as a seventh grader. Like that's when I started to come out of my shell. They kind of pushed me back into it. When like this harassment was happening. And then when at court, my one singular comment about the shoes got brought up. And because of that, the judge screamed at all of us, like in all of our faces, said that if any one of us, including me, if we ended up in front of him again before graduation, we were all going to juvie. And mind you, in this conversation, I'm giving like very explicit, like, this person smacked me, this person touched me, this person threatened to kill me. And while I didn't make a great comment because I made that comment and it was one versus like six or seven, it was basically like a slap in the wrist for these boys. And I went into the next year a raging, angry feminist. Like, and it just got worse as high school went on because I had some really amazing teachers, especially history teachers. And when I began learning about women's liberation, civil rights, etc., I just wanted to burn the whole fucking world down. And then, you know, everything else happened, and I later learned about restorative justice.
Which brings me to the next question. What is restorative justice to you?
Yeah. So that's a great way of phrasing it because restorative justice is honestly something different to different people. I have actually been learning about it from a more indigenous framework. So like from actual like indigenous cultures and tribes, but also some very old like religious groups such as Quakers. But restorative justice is basically the idea of addressing harm by bringing folks involved together to take responsibility, but in different ways. So, not necessarily going through courts, not necessarily long-term incarceration. And honestly, in America, it doesn't really necessarily exist the way that people dream and scheme. Like, it's definitely something that's on the rise, particularly in Canada. That's also, what brought me to the space, Marley, with the Survivors for Justice Reform movement, like what she's been doing in Canada and like being the first case to go through restorative justice, just completely incredible. But basically, the community is usually involved, the person that caused harm is involved, and most importantly, the victim wants to go through this and wants accountability, wants the person to explicitly say that they did what they did. And then typically, these groups will come together and decide upon what quote unquote punishment will be.
Absolutely. Have you ever heard of the term decolonization of self-care?
Oh, yes. Yes, yes, yes,
So,
yes.
whenever you're talking about like indigenous tribes and talking about like these oppressive systems, speaking of which, I have a book recommendation if you want to actually read something. It's not necessarily out just yet. I was able to get like an advanced reading copy of my friend Erin Gallagher's book, and it is called Hype Women: Breaking Free from Mean Girls, Patriarchy, and System Silencing You. This is an incredible book that I can already tell you. And it is beautiful. It is beautifully written. She goes in uncandidly and really just kind of pipes off. But the even better part is it has a foreword by Jamie Lee Curtis. And incredible human being, Erin Gallagher. You can find her on social media. But whenever we're talking about those systems and these systems of oppression and talking about the decolonization of self-care, because it involves critiques of the wellness industry, but also the reclaimization of the ancestral practices, and really brings that community and collective care, which is where the colonization comes in and rips that away, and it goes into consumerism. And consumerism contributes to capitalism. God damn it. Capitalism leads into white supremacy and silencing of voices further into the systems of care that is supposed to protect us, but it actually ends up failing future generations. And we're stuck in this like trickle-down economic hellscape that fucks over people like you and me and my mom being a disabled woman, and thinking about that consumerism, and it comes to end like the individualism versus consumerism and like community versus, singular, and focusing on that. Whenever I think of consumerism, I think of Starbucks. Yeah. Because let's be real, I think of Starbucks because it's like, okay, yes, I love pumpkin spice, but at the same time, my mom needs, just random things outside of that, right? So it's like the individual versus community approach. And it's a perfect way of putting it. And like the decolonizing is like the holistic well-being and the intersectionality of all of, race, gender, class, ability, the impact of that self-care and the well-being for all the different types of people. But whenever you hear decolonizing of self-care, what do you do to reclaim some of those ancestral practices and focus on the community and the collective care?
That's a really great question. So I want to say this relates exactly to what I was trying to say. I shouldn't say trying to say earlier, what I did say earlier. I had said that part of the reason that I had burnt out was because there wasn't a lot of institutional support. It was putting it on the individual. And I think putting self-care and healing on the individual is a terrible thing to do. And you're right, it's absolutely intertwined with capitalism. We get pushed to do like spa days, face masks, buy wine, like do these different like self-care activities where you have to spend money. And that in itself is something we need to work on in the survivor space. But to answer your question, what do I do for self-care? There's a couple of things that have like changed my life, especially as I do try to decolonize, because that in itself is a lifelong practice as a white person, as a white woman. I have been in IFS, internal family systems therapy, since the beginning of this year. And it's a very great, trauma therapy. I am, even though I've been in it for a while, like I'm still learning, I'm not perfect with it, but it's basically identifying all of the different parts that make me who I am. And I directly relate this to like trauma healing and colonization because I, as a survivor, realized that I am surviving because I want to be in control of my triggers, my reactions, etc. And IFS is one way to do that. It's really sitting with yourself and your different parts that may have kind of come out of a different event, a different whether it is piece of trauma or drama, it's sitting with yourself and trying to identify why you feel that way and what that part needs for you to move on. And in doing this work, I've noticed that a lot of like internal issues really are just based in living in a colonized country on colonized land, having a colonized mind, viewing things in black and white. So I've been doing a lot of work to not be that way. And that's especially hard as a neurodivergent woman. Like, I do see a lot of things in black and white. So I'm putting a lot of time into journaling and, you know, sitting and thinking about why I might act a certain way, how my trauma intertwines with patriarchy, intertwines with, you know, all of the other things. And that's actually kind of led to some of the work that I do with Philly Feminist. So in the last couple of months, we've started to get together as a collective of gender-based violence survivors, and we've been doing like self-care practices that involve burning pieces of paper that are either letters to ourselves, letters to our abusers, letters to the patriarchy or the system itself. We've started to do that, and I want to start doing it once a month. I quite literally, you know, as I thought of this idea, I found a cauldron in a thrift store, and we have been trying to spend time together, you know, working through these bigger issues that are directly related to colonization and patriarchy and how that impacts survivorhood. And it's really difficult. We've had, you know, we've had people cry. I've cried. It's really beautiful as it's difficult. And then also, just spending time touching grass. I've recently spent a lot of time in the park near my house, where I take a blanket and I sit with the trees and I talk to the trees. And the reason that I've started talking to the trees is because a former coworker of mine, who I really look up to, does a lot of really great conflict resolution work, told me that every day, you know, they grounded themselves by talking to the trees on the way to work and would talk about kind of like the things that were going on, kind of the issues, and like was really a great way to kind of sit with themselves, sit with the environment, take a breath before doing like the very difficult work. So, like, I've started to do that. I've been doing it since like June, and I've honestly been just talking shit to the trees about everything that's going on. And it honestly feels kind of good because I feel like I'm screaming to the void. I'm putting my feet in the grass and I'm straight up using that time to then journal, read more. I've taken friends to this park and like they've done it with me. Like it's just really beautiful. And like I feel like, you know, putting your body in nature and trying to incorporate healing with it. Like fire in itself, that's nature. And like burning things that have been destructive to you feels very releasing.
Whew. All right, my friend, you are getting deep into this and I'm loving it. And let's keep going. So whenever we think about self-care and we think about like the grounding techniques and we think about the transformation of self-care from a radical political act of resistance for marginalized communities, you can't help but think about the appropriating practices from Indigenous and Black cultures. And going back to the original roots of what self-care is supposed to look like, the appropriation and the deep contextualization, like yoga and meditation, it's been extracted, and it's been very commercialized and stripped of that communal significance, and thinking about that, lot of people use yoga, and I personally cannot sit through a yoga class because I have, ADHD, and it definitely I lose my focus, and I lose the why I'm there, right? And then if I'm sitting there and I'm doing yoga and I'm meditating, I start thinking, my legs start shaking, and I do this like really deep thinking, and that's kind of scary. Let's be real. But what are some other ways that you do self-care? So you mentioned about journaling. You mentioned about going to a park and like lighting, some things on fire, and especially like a letter to yourself. I'm envisioning like writing a letter to like a deep dark part of your life and then like setting it on fire. And it's kind of like that. I'm envisioning that. It's kind of like, is that kind of like what you're really getting at there?
Yeah, we exactly that. I've written letters to myself. I've written letters to my abusers. I've written letters to honestly the void of just my anger towards, gender-based violence or even the rise of authoritarianism. And, those things are connected. So I should note that. But you make a good point. So for example, some of those practices, like the yoga and the meditation, I'm like fairly certain 99% of the places in Philadelphia that I've been to where I live, it's really whitewashed yoga. And I similarly like wasn't really feeling it. I do a lot of stretching at home now, but there was a point in time where when I was in these classes, like I was actually incredibly uncomfortable to sit there and see how we were all white people being taught by mostly white people. There were a couple of women of color instructors that I've seen throughout the years, but it's just like in general, like those spaces, even like it's mostly white women. So like I feel like that in itself as a self-care practice is like deeply rooted in colonization. I do try to do like breathing techniques in my own house, but it's like the square breathing that we learn as victim advocates as one of the many exercises we can do with survivors to kind of get their bearings. I know there are folks that do things like burning sage and like they do other like very, very clearly stolen self-care things. And that's what I absolutely try to stay away from. When we have people kind of come around and like burn things, maybe we'll have like a couple of prompts like, let's focus on what we want to release in our personal life or from our past traumas today. But generally, people can use that space to do whatever we want, and we don't want it to be too rigid. Definitely, rigidity is based in colonization as well. So we try to avoid that and make the spaces as like open and fluid as possible.
Absolutely. I think that's a crucial part of it, that decolonization is so incredibly crucial in today's society, especially. And thinking about that, with the way that the country is and the way that the world is, what is one way that people can get involved? What would you recommend getting involved in an organization? Would you recommend getting involved in a movement? What would you recommend to somebody who is wanting to make change, but they're not sure how to do it?
So I definitely have a couple of very big opinions on this. I first of all believe that we can't do it all and we can't do it alone. And I also believe that we cannot or and should not reinvent the wheel. There are, of course, spaces where we really do need to go out and create the new space. But I feel like these days, like 2025, when a lot of people are now really waking up and seeing, authoritarianism for what it is, they're starting to kind of panic. And I feel like that's a really natural reaction, especially if you've been kind of like on the outskirts of politics or apolitical. My recommendation is for people to find maybe one or two, action or item-based advocacy organizations to start with and go from there. I would honestly recommend that people look into local mutual aid groups and groups that are not for profit, so like nonprofits for the most part, neighborhood coalitions, collectives, because that's going to be the way that you keep yourself out of, for the most part, these capitalist spaces. So to be honest, you might even want to keep yourself out of certain nonprofits. I think there are a lot of nonprofits with the best intentions, but there's a lot that have to uphold, a lot of pieces of white supremacy. So it's just being very careful in that sense. But mutual aid is always a great way to go. I didn't note this in the beginning, but my partner and I, two or three times a month, we go out, we clean up trash with our neighbors. That's a version of mutual aid. I have a couple of friends that try to do like food pickups for the local community fridges, or we'll just kind of like spend $5, $10 a week putting, things in themselves, doing like really direct action work. Right now, that's also like gardening, teaching you yourself and your neighbors how to garden and really be self-sufficient. And then I also think just movements is a great thing too if you are someone that's interested in a lot of things. So for example, the Rise Above Justice movement, there's a lot of intersections that initially drew me to this work. Also, I'm Philadelphia based. There's a lot of coalitions. For example, the Philadelphia Abortion Rights Coalition that I'm also a part of, reproductive justice and body autonomy. There's a million intersections, and one of that is advocating for the children and people in Gaza against genocide. The United States and all of our involvement, especially locally. There's a lot of organizing that's happening that if you just look up, to be honest, your local Democratic Socialist organization or a coalition that speaks to you, you're going to find like a lot of places with people that, can help point you in the right direction. Philly Feminist, again, that's one of them. Rise Above Justice Movement, Survivors for Justice Reform. There's so many great survivor-based movements that exist that people don't necessarily have to reinvent the wheel. Or if there is like a limited space in your maybe rural area, using the Rise Above Justice Movement or Survivors for Justice and Survivors for Justice Reform to connect yourself and like the few people around to something bigger so that you can, mobilize more people.
As a card-carrying member of the DSA, thank you for mentioning that. I absolutely love the DSA. I love everything that they're doing, calling out all the bullshit. They always have, they always will. They're winning elections. And speaking of elections, have you been watching like the New York City mayor race?
I have. And one of my best friends, this is another best friend that I've known since fourth grade, not the originally mentioned one. She's actually a dancer in New York City. And she joined the group Hot Girls for Zohran, and she's been doing some canvassing with them. So I've been like in the loop with her and just like paying attention to the news, and I'm very intrigued by, how that's going.
We had the opportunity to sit down and talk to Lindsay Boylan. Lindsay was the first person that came out against Andrew Cuomo and as a former aide whenever Andrew Cuomo was governor of New York. She went in very detailedly, talked about his abuses of power, talked about what she experienced. And she was the, like I said, she was the very first woman that came out and, and spoke out against him and revealed the sexual misconduct that she faced while being one of his staff members towards the end of his governorship. And Lindsay is somebody that speaks so eloquently and does it in such a good way that it reaches the broad audience. And highly recommend, anybody who's listening to go back and listen to that episode because it's very good. All of the episodes that we're doing, and this is kind of a shameless plug, but we're bringing people together. We have 200 and something thousand followers on Instagram and almost 32,000 on Threads and then 1,000 on Blue Sky. But it's never been about the amount of followers that we have. It's all about the content that we're putting out. We collaborate with content creators. We've collaborated with Philly Feminists. We've collaborated with Survivors for Justice Reform. We collaborate on a regular basis with Marley from Survivors for Justice Reform. And, we collaborate with some Congress members. And it's transformed into this whole like international movement, because I'm talking to people in Canada, I'm talking to people in the United Kingdom, Australia, and kind of like seeing from a worldview, right? And you mentioned about like children in Gaza. Like, yes, absolutely. That's something that we're watching very closely with the flotillas and watching everything and getting aid into Gaza. That is definitely something that I've been watching very religiously and very closely. I'm in a couple group chats watching that. And, it's arming and funding, that's a whole different topic, right? Because there's a lot that can go into that. And again, it goes into the decolonization too. And thinking about a number of different ways about the intersectionality. And you mentioned it earlier about the rise of justice movement hitting on a lot of different topics. And I did that intentionally because if you think about it, everything that's going on is connected right in the center. And
Exactly.
it comes from that colonization, and it comes from the oppressive systems that are supposed to work for us, that work against us, and it's supposed to, do this and do that. But in the end, it ends up fucking us over. And we continue to fall into this capitalistic society. But also thinking about the deep police state too, thinking about that too, and the militarization of our police departments, not believing survivors. We have gun violence running rampant through our communities, and the selective outrage is what really gets me. And it's like, we're going to condemn this, but we're not going to condemn this. We hear thoughts and prayers whenever a school shooting happens, but we get an Air Force jet for somebody who is not an elected official. So it's definitely, I'm not mentioning any names, but if anybody's been watching the headlines, you know what I'm talking about whenever I see them.
Yeah.
And it's something that is very, it weighs heavy on our minds, but I can't help but think about those Sandy Hook children, the Uvalde children, where police stood outside for 70 something minutes, letting children be slaughtered in their classrooms. And the answer to that is thoughts and prayers. I am so sick and tired of being sick and tired whenever it comes to gun violence. My best friend was shot and killed last year, and I watched what the family went through, and I know how I felt during it. I can't imagine how her mom felt, how her sister felt, and how her seven children no longer have a mother. Where's the outrage for families like that? Where is the outrage? If we were truly a pro-life nation, those Sandy Hook children would have graduated last year and they would have started college this year. We're not a pro-life nation. We are pro-forced birth because once the child is born, we can give a fuck less what happens to it. Because we take away the Medicaid, we take away their basic bodily autonomy. And my reason for the work that I do is not for me. As a survivor myself, I went through some very fucked up things. But at the same time, it's not about me. It's about that 12-year-old that is hiding in the closet that does not have a right to her own body because the court said so. It is because of my mom, who is also a survivor, who is disabled and going through cancer treatments and battling with the state of Missouri over her Medicaid that she deserves. Because healthcare is an absolute fucking human right. And whenever we deny that, we are saying it is okay for people like my mom to die because those cancer treatments are astronomically fucking high. And I know I'm popping off, but that is the point of this podcast, is to amplify those stories that don't reach the headlines. Mainstream media is complicit in silence, and they're not going to cover my mom's story. They're not going to cover my story. They're not going to cover your story because they're complicit in the silence. They are paid for it. They are bought for it. And that is what is wrong with the country. In a
Yeah.
nutshell, it goes deeper. It goes deeper. It goes way deeper.
No, absolutely. And you're right. Colonization's at the center of all of it. And just to really quickly, touch on Gaza again, it's absolutely connected to the struggle for body autonomy because I sit here and I think all the time about how pregnant people in Gaza are given birth without any type of medicine, in places where hospitals are blown up, so they might not even be giving birth in a medical facility. Like there's state-sanctioned sexual and reproductive violence going on over in Palestine. And then that's connected to, what your mom's going through. It's a different type of violence. It's a different type of state-based violence and healthcare violence. And it's again connected to then what I do here in Philadelphia with the Philadelphia Abortion Rights Coalition. We show up to a clinic a couple times a month, especially right now because it's the start of 40 Days for Life tomorrow. Where these religious extremists, the same people that don't, want your mom to have health care, they want these forced births, and they will go to these women's clinics, get in the faces of, clients and people that work at the clinic. So we go there to put our bodies in between to make sure that they're not doing that. Like, this is fascism. This is terrible. And I thank you for being, super candid with your mom always. But like, I absolutely see the direct, connection between all of the things that we're talking about. Like, it's all state violence. It colonization in itself, state violence.
Exactly. It directly relates, that directly connects, and we think about the oligarchy and the patriarchy and the white supremacy, and we think about the religions, the Christian nationalism, the white nationalism, and we live in it. We see it on, every time I get on my phone, I always go to the headlines because I'm just waiting one of these days to say, oh, we're ending Medicaid for every single person. All it takes is a stroke of a pen and lives are literally ruined, including my mom. She can't afford these cancer treatments because we live in a for-profit healthcare system that would rather profit off of her illnesses than actually address what is happening to her. And I'm not convinced by now that there's not a cure for cancer. I'm not convinced. I'm not convinced that there's not a cure for literally everything, but we continue to pad the pockets of the pharmaceutical companies, big pharma, and big tech that continues to fail us as a society. And oof, that opens up a whole different conversation that none of us have time to actually do a deep dive into, but we don't have to because we're living in this, it feels like an alternate universe. At oftentimes it feels like this alternate society and this alternate, universe that we're just kind of stuck in, and then you have TV shows. Like, don't get me wrong, I absolutely love the Special Victims Unit, but it makes it look so easy that you could just walk into a police department and say, "Hey, I was raped," and then they take you in this, this room and they ask you questions. It's not like that, at least for
Absolutely
me,
not.
when
Nope.
I. At least for me, whenever I walked into my local police department, they looked at me and said, "Well, you're a man. Why didn't you fight him off? Were you not strong enough to fight him off? Who exactly are you serving and protecting when you're protecting your own?" And I eventually, later on, like years down the road, after I became sober, and then after I was sexually assaulted again, I finally was able to file the report with that police department, with the help of a victim advocate, with a local organization here in Kansas City. I was able to get that support that I needed. And the detective that I talked to was actually very apologetic. And I said, "I don't want your fucking apologies. I want you to do your fucking job and make sure this doesn't happen to anybody else. You have failed your community. You need to correct this. Because if it happened to me, how many others did it happen to?" Whenever I came forward with my story on the local news station, I got four DMs, all four from survivors, all four from the same police department, that they experienced the same thing that I did. Obviously, it was mainly women, but it was still, the not believing part. And I felt that and I seen that. And then, some of those survivors have went silent. Some of the survivors are still very active, like myself. But I had this national and like global approach to the work that I'm doing because it's not just here in Missouri, it's not just here in Kansas or Pennsylvania or wherever. It's all over. Sexual violence literally runs rampant, just like gun violence, just like domestic violence, just like racism. It's literally in all facets of our lives. And we see that. I grew up around war. I grew up during 9/11. I grew up seeing, Afghanistan. And then what's happening in Gaza now, and we see it. It's all I know. It's all I grew up around. It's all that we see on the headlines, but we don't see anything positive. And what I'm trying to do is show the stories of survival to give people a sense of hope, to give people the sense of belonging in a society that would rather us stay silent and not call out these systems in. Contribute to repression. At a certain point of my life, I was a part of the oppression because I felt like society was pushing me there and I was believing what I was being told. But then I had to learn that wasn't right. That's not correct. And it was a very harsh reality that, and whenever it hit me very hard. But to anybody out there who is listening, Jay, what would be one piece of advice that you would give to somebody that's just starting out in their healing journey after trauma? What is the piece of advice that you would give to somebody and why?
Yeah, absolutely. So I feel like healing and and trauma, it's a completely different language. So it absolutely is going to change a lot of things. It's going to change relationship dynamics, the way you respond to things, just your overall, worldview and the lens in which you view things. So I think it's first of all really important to find one or two people that are honestly the people that you can always lean into and call, even if you are a survivor that perhaps finds yourself incredibly dysregulated or triggered. You need people on your mental health care team that aren't necessarily your therapist, your psychiatrist. You need like your friends, you need a family member, you need someone from your community. I recommend finding that person as soon as you can. And if you do have a limited social network, I highly encourage reaching out to a local neighborhood-based victim advocate. And I say neighborhood-based rather than just general victim advocate because there are system-based advocates, which is different, and I'm noting that because they typically work with in a police office, district attorney's office. And I'm not saying there's anything inherently bad with that, especially if that's the only resource in your area. But I recommend neighborhood-based because typically there's like less requirements. You don't have to necessarily share all the same information or necessarily report. Whereas some of the systems-based advocates, you unfortunately do have to report. But victim advocates are like a very great tool that I feel like a lot of folk don't know about. I'm glad that you mentioned your own victim advocate and how important that was for you and, even getting like a little bit of accountability from police. The whole reason I became a victim advocate is because I didn't have a victim advocate. And if at any point I had someone that kind of intervened, helped explain the system and helped me navigate it, I would have had completely different outcomes as a tween teenager. And then I always kind of wonder, like, would I have reported my date rape in college? Would I have reported that? I, was wearing of what people would consider a provocative outfit. I was drunk. I don't remember most of what happened. I just kind of remember, flashes and like, trigger warning, I was also stealthed in this incident. So like I really wish that I had, reached out to someone, a victim advocate, to see what my options were because while I didn't want to report and I'm not sure I would have necessarily wanted to report, it would have been really nice to have someone to go with me to Planned Parenthood when I was then dealing with, the aftermath of being stealthed and all the tests that come with that and just how scary it was. It would have been nice to have someone to kind of walk me through mental health options in the city. I just really recommend building your network. And then from there, once you kind of feel a little bit safe, seeing what else you need, like checking in with like the longer term health, mental health care. There's nothing wrong with medication. There's nothing wrong with group, reaching out to like a group therapist or support. But if those aren't, something you're interested in, again, I want to bring up like these different movements where you can maybe join a call every month and talk to other survivors that are doing political advocacy. Everybody gets something different out of being a survivor. Like some folks really find empowerment from, doing the advocacy work down the line. Other people just, find the comfort in doing the self-healing and being vulnerable with loved ones. That's kind of what my starting advice would be. Also, just being very patient to yourself. I know it's cliche, but healing isn't linear, especially if you're victimized and find yourself victimized multiple times after that. It really is like a journey, and you have to find radical acceptance and people that will play a role in radically accepting you.
Absolutely. Jay, I want to thank you for coming on to our podcast. And to anybody out there who is listening, please continue to uplift the stories of survivors and people that are doing the work on the ground. And with that, our podcast is available on all streaming platforms, on all major streaming platforms, also on our YouTube. And be sure to follow our social media at Rise of Justice Movement. And with that, Jay, thank you so much for being on the podcast. And you have an open invite anytime you would like to talk about anything.
Thank you for this time and space. And honestly, thank you for all the work that you've been doing in the last year and then some.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like the whole 16 years wrapped in one. All right. Thank you so much, my friend. You have a good day, okay?
You too.